Welcome to Casual Watch Talk, the podcast from the Casual Watch Reviewer YouTube channel. Join us as we talk everything watches, from watch collecting, the latest horology news and interviews. If you're not already subscribed, subscribe on your favourite podcast app. Let's dive into the show. Hello everyone, and welcome back to episode 43 of Casual Watch Talk. We're back just to audio this week after, I think, a pretty successful Zoom live stream where we did the podcast both in audio format and also live on the YouTube channel. So check that out. We were kindly joined by some of our Facebook subscribers, weren't we, Chris?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And you did a hell of a job putting edits in there. Pictures, etc., which is cool, adds to it. So if you heard it on the podcast, certainly worth it to flip through the YouTube and check it out.
Yeah, it was really good. And big thanks to everyone that joined Chris and I. It was just awesome to hear about all the 30-day watch challenges. And we've definitely got some ideas for the next one. I know I've certainly got two or three that I would like to see and have some collaboration on.
Nice.
Well, as always, we love to kick it off with watch obsessions. I think this week we've got a couple of news stories, and then we're going to do, for the main part of the show, something which I find fascinating, and I think it's one of the most talked about subjects on most watch forums, I think, which is watch loom. So we're going to kind of go through a bit of the history and then talk about modern photoluminescence loom. So stick around for that and you'll get to hear our views on it. But Chris, as always, I throw the gauntlet to you for watch obsession.
Not too much of a watch obsession this week. I feel like the Facebook meetup sort of took it out of me. So I was reassessing. We talked about sort of reassessing the collection and things like that. But as far as no big obsession this week. I've been switching back and forth. Certainly grabbed a couple watches. I actually threw the Zin 103 / Bell & Ross chronograph on to leather because it has been a little cooler here. I don't know if you experienced that across the way. Down in the below the 70s, mid to low 70s, which is cool for us here in Southern California. And so it was nice to get the watch on leather. It was the official, like, the mark of fall and heading into winter is when I like to switch over to leather straps. And if I'm sweating at all, I just can't do it. So that was my big obsession this week. But other than keeping track of your Walbrook, which is cool, kind of a extended obsession where we timed that out, seems like that's running well.
Yeah, it's doing really well. Yeah, we changed the movement to, and we were a bit unsure, weren't we, because it was a Chinese clone of a Miyota movement, which is a clone of an ETA movement.
Right, yeah, it's like a copy of a copy of a copy, and a little hit or miss, but we bought it from a reputable place, and it seemed I put it right on the, before I even did anything with it, I put it on the time grapher, and it was like 2 seconds, doing pretty good in a couple of positions, so really cool.
Had a crazy first week with it, maybe like a new puppy or something, but once it settled down,
yeah,
getting some really good results in it. Okay. It's okay. Sort of variance of between 1 and 2 seconds a day, so hopefully that lasts. But yeah, I guess my watch obsession has been, I don't know what's going on, but I think as I near my milestone birthday, which is coming up in 2 weeks, I wasn't going to buy a watch for it. Then I got into a panic of, should I buy a watch for it? And then my wife, basically, she said to me, you can have any watch you like within reason, obviously.
Okay, okay.
But you have to keep it. And you know what I'm like, Chris? Like,
oh, God.
As soon as I met my wife, within a couple of weeks, I knew I was going to marry her. Like, I have no commitment issues except for when it comes to watches. Yeah. Could I commit to a one watch for forever to be handed down generations? And then I just don't know. So do I get something like, do I go big and get maybe like a Rolex, even though...
I feel like that's grail territory, right? You know, like, are you just going to get the Grail watch. You're just going to get the watch. And like what it, and what is the current Grail watch?
Exactly. What right. is it like? So the Rolex is, there's none that I love except for the Datejust 41 with mm-hmm. the gray dial and the smooth, the non-fluted bezel. But they're like $8,000. And I don't know. I'm struggling. I thought about Christopher Ward. I thought about even that Frederick Constant, the High Life one I think I shared with you. So I'm in like a bit of an irrational panic, even though I actually like all my watches that I've got now. I love that Breitling, right. this Woolbrook. I'm actually thinking of getting rid of some of my watches, but I'm on this panicky mess of, do I need something for my 40th? And what should it be? I looked at the Breitling Super Ocean. And then there's this whole thing of like, then I have to like it enough that I would keep it forever.
You keep it forever. I think it's that's the stress that's really pushing the, that's kind of killing the buzz on that, because you're like, if you are just free to get anything, but then you're like, but I got to keep it because it's my 40th, you know? Like,
yeah, but this is the thing. I don't love a Rolex Datejust, but I'm trying to like predict future Sam when, you know, I'm right. sat on.
Right. What does 53-year-old Sam say? Let's go to the future. You're like, wow, it's a good thing I kept that Datejust. Like, geez, those things are $12,000 now or whatever.
Exactly.
You know, in
the exactly. Because what, 5 years ago when, or maybe 5 years ago when most things were in ready supply from Rolex.
Right.
And you would have looked at a Submariner and gone, oh, wow, God, $5,000's a bit.
I know, right?
Submariner. And, now, if you could go back in time, you would have bought four.
I know. I 2 years ago, I looked at the Seiko, the Grand Seiko Diver.
Oh,
and I tried it on. I tried it on. It was just a little too big. I just kind of couldn't go for it. But you know, I really liked it. Really liked it. But there was just something about it. And definitely, possibly, it was the price. And I'm like, And the dealer was like, I could probably do $4,800. And now I'm looking and I'm like, you idiot. You know, to pick up a Grand Seiko Diver for, you know, from an AD brand new for like $4,800. You're like, what am I doing? What did I do?
It would have been a bargain, wouldn't it? And I even looked at Zinn, your favorite.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's any suggestions, head on over to the Facebook
know.
Guys.
Yeah, I
if
guess
you can help
so.
Me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some sweet relief from this.
I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, but I mean, I love my Breitling. I'm not lusting after a watch because I want to add one to the collection. It's more to do with this milestone birthday. And I know that it's funny because in 1980 is that weird transitional year most people were kind of like, oh, should we really do mechanical watches anymore?
Right.
Or should we just get on the bandwagon with quartz? Because it was, I think the quartz crisis was fully in its swing by then.
Right.
So, because I even asked Josh Wolfe, who a friend of the show who does Hamilton restoration, whether there was any Hamiltons around that period. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't often see them. I see like 70s, you know, mid to late 70s.
Where it sloughed off. And then only what in the 90s or whatever when Swatch Group got them going again. Really interesting. Yeah. All right. So I have a suggestion. Here's what we do. Pick up like a really fun looking Swatch. Like for, you know, $150, okay? And then just don't say anything and then go spend $5,000 on something else.
and then
like, there's your 40. This is my year 40 watch. And just like, you know, post it up on Instagram, all smiles, because you can keep that. You definitely keep that, no problem. Because it's not like you're going to, you know, what are you going to flip it on eBay? But yeah, I think you're right, though. I feel like if you get yourself into something, you know, if you get yourself into an OP or a Datejust or something, that's got some cash behind it, if anything happens, you're just going to look at that thing and be like, well, there's $7,000 sitting there.
Exactly. Or if they do go up even more in price, or they get discontinued. I mean, I even really seriously, I know I give Braymont a half-hearted hard time on the channel sometimes, but I looked at the Braymont. You can get them secondhand for, there's ones that are a year to 2 years old that are 900 less than retail.
That's great.
On, and especially like in the UK, because I imagine most of the Bremonts that are being sold come from the UK. We have to pay a 20% VAT on top of that. So they're taking a significant hit on these. But even secondhand, I think some of these Bremonts are gorgeous. The divers, I still think they're a tad too expensive.
But at least if you go used, then you're not worried. You may be less worried about the dents and scratches.
Yes, that's true.
And then you'd get a decent deal on it, so you don't have to pay the depreciation on it. So then you're not looking at the depreciation sitting there. So that's a tough one, Sam.
Yeah, it really is. And the more I learn about Breitling, I don't know what I ever thought of Breitling originally, whether I just thought it was a bit flashy, blah, 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 and it's kind of the whole pilot thing that they were milking. But the more I learn about the company and how they make the watches, there's a fascinating documentary on Netflix, but it's, sorry, not Netflix, on YouTube, but it's made by one of those, like, how it's made type TV shows.
Oh, okay.
So the guy, like, narrating it really has no idea about watches.
Yeah, yeah, he's
so
reading off the list. He keeps
calling the dial the face.
Oh, geez.
It's so annoying. And like, there's other things that are like,
at least
have done the modicum of research on this. But it's actually quite good. It goes into a lot of the history. I need to do a proper, when I review my Breitling B1 properly, I will do a little bit of history. Because Breitling, I think, has got one of the most fascinating histories going. But anyway, let's do a couple of news stories from this week, and then we'll do a quick break and then jump into our main topic. So news story, have you seen the new in-house Oris? This movement that Oris have made, it's apparently got a 5-day power reserve. It's amazing, isn't it?
That is,
and then COSC. Well, it says it will pass COSC standards. It's like -3 to +5 seconds a day.
Okay.
But Scottish Watches picked up something straight away from the movement. And Chris, did you notice it as well?
I didn't pick up on this. But
so if anyone's seen this movement, it's called the Calibre 400. It's a pretty looking movement. It's not heavily decorated. It looks extremely industrial, and there's a lot of writing
clean
on it.
Yeah, clean would be my description of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great description. But when the rotor's in a certain position, and Scottish Watches did this on their Facebook group, it actually looks like the outline of their famous bear logo that they use for their charity endeavors.
I can see that.
So the ears, the eyes, and the mouth.
Yeah, like the two gears, the two main power gears are sort of poking out on the sides, look like little ears, and then the jewels. Yeah, totally. And then the way they sort of circularly cut the where the balance was. That's cool.
it does look more like a smile each time they do it. But so I'm not sure. Let us know on the Facebook group if you know this. I was trying to do some research before, but I can't see what watch it's going to be in. But they are offering a 10-year warranty on it. So,
so it's amazing. Yeah, that's a 5 days, 120 hours of power reserve. So I think, and I'll have to do some more research in it. It looks like it might have two barrels in it, is what I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but
no, I think the gears, the two ears.
I think so. But that amount, like it's interesting to me. Just working, you know, fun time modding, working on watches. I mean, I know the amount of energy that's stored in that little barrel spring. Once you wind that thing 40 times, there's some serious torque there that's ready to pop out, and I cannot imagine how much torque is on the gear train with a fully wound 120 hour barrel. That's little metal grenade ready to go off there. That's a ton of energy in there. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what watch that comes in. Next news story is Bell and Ross, their BR05, which I think it was fair, got a bit of a trolling when it first came out because it was a little tad like a Nautilus. But have you seen the new chronograph version that they've released?
Yeah, I did when it popped into my inbox. It looks pretty good. I like it in the blue. With the smaller markers, one of the things I didn't like of the first release was the blue didn't have the smaller minute track markers, so they only came in black. They did that, and so with the chronograph now they sort of have the identical dial, and I like the individual little minute track. I think it looks a little more sporty, a little more useful, because I feel like if you're going to, you know, this is a very TJ comment, but like if you're going to have a chronograph, you kind of need like markers where the hands line up exactly with the markers so you can actually count the seconds and not be, you know, and not be for show. And Bellen Ross has done it here with, you know, it looks like the seconds hand lines perfectly up with those markers, and it's got a constant 60 and then a 30 minute on the left-hand side, kind of opposite to how typically it is. But
I didn't realize that about the second on the outside track that you said mm-hmm. before on that, on the previous watch. It reminds me, we were having a really interesting conversation over on the Facebook group about the little details in a watch that can ruin it for when you buy it. And then I sort of proposed the question, I think we need to move this into a maybe another group meetup where we talk about this and film it for the YouTube, or I'll make a YouTube video on it. Is the more you learn about watches, does that mean that it's very rare that you're truly happy with a watch?
Right.
What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, we've talked about like checking the boxes, and it's interesting how sometimes you get into this mode where you're like, oh, it has to have this and it has to have this and this. And then if it doesn't have the one thing, and a lot of times you sort of have to take a breath and like calm down about it, you know, like, okay, it doesn't have a screw down crown, but it's 100 meter water resistance because it has like modern silicone sills, and it's if you splash yourself into a pool, it's not going to be a big deal, you know, this kind of thing. So it's these stats that you're kind of like, as you learn about watches, you have to like let go of some of this stuff. But speaking of nitpick stuff, I will say, I truly feel that the way Bellen Ross does their date wheel is amazing. If you're gonna do an offset, make it so that the date is horizontal, and so they have a 4:30 date, but it's perpendicular horizontal to the rest of the dial. So when the numbers pop in there, and they do that with all their vintage line too. My V2 GMT is that way as well. Not that I can see that little number now that I'm getting older, but but it's there. I don't like.
That version of your watch with that blue and gray dial, is that something else, that isn't it?
Yeah.
I was looking at that this week.
Yeah. When I glanced at it, I was like, oh, that's you know, fun color. I kind of wish they kept the GMT orange, but they went with the blue, the red on that. So red and blue, little different. So, but yeah, very different, you know, fun color variation for sure. Something that you don't typically see.
Last news story we've got here is actually going back to Breitling. I was just plugging them before, but they've created this, an app or at least a digital passport based web service, which I think the idea of apps is, I can't think of another watch company that has an app where it's not like just a digital catalog, but it seems like this is actually something that looks pretty cool. So they're going to, each watch is going to come with a digital passport on it that's going to have all of your warranty information, all of the repairs. So essentially it's going to be like a digital logbook of the watch. And the idea of this is not only is it going to be obviously excellent for owners, but when it comes into the secondary market, then you're going to be able to share this information with it and authenticate the watch as well, see whether it's stolen and things like that. I think this is a great idea. They trialed it and now they're actually rolling it out now. I think it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this is something that many Swiss watch, you know, companies haven't really tackled, you know, this, where the watch is reported stolen or that they have sort of a registration. I mean, I find myself sending emails about, you know, the vintage stuff that I have all the time, and just, you know, oh, when, you know, when was it made? Is it, do you have any information on if it was ever serviced, these sorts of things. And, you know, sometimes brands can certainly help you out, but it's a, you know, an email back and forth 4 or 5 times, this sort of thing. So it's kind of nice to have, you know, in the future, a whole sort of a logbook of what has happened to your watch.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of like Omega, what's it? They want like $120 for a print from the archives or whatever they call it, an extraction from the archives, I think they call it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, before we dive into our main subject here, we'll just pause for a very quick ad break. And just something that I mentioned on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, if you're interested in advertising on Casual Watch Talk with Chris and I, email us over at thecasualwatchreviewer@gmail.com, because the adverts that we put in here are designed or are inserted by our podcasting provider, which we're very grateful for. But obviously, it would be cool if there was some like watch-related adverts, so it's a bit more interesting for the listeners. Anyway, we'll pause for a quick ad break here.
Hey, it's Chris from the Casual Watch Talk podcast. As our longtime listeners know, we often talk about cars here on the pod, and that's no coincidence. Like a lot of mechanical watch lovers, we're both into cars and racing. A couple years ago, I curated a collection of automotive-inspired straps and started the Camping Auto Club. Camping Auto Club watch straps celebrate the rich history of automotive liveries with their inspired colors. Available in a single-pass NATO, two-piece, and our new super comfy elastic NATO. Check out Camping Auto Club on the web. That's championship in Italian, CampioNato.club.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Casual Watch Talk. So for our main subject today, we're going to be talking all about lume. And we'll go into a bit of the history about luminescence on a watch. And also, I don't know, Chris, I think this is probably... I know there's a lot of controversial watch subjects, isn't there? But lume is quite a controversial subject, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it is. And it also, it sort of breaks off into, it's like a catalyst for other like controversial. So you know, we'll talk about different paint colors and things like that. And just, yeah. I mean, you can get, I feel like it's the source of absolutely a lot of controversy.
It's funny, what spurred this off for me wanting to do this as a subject was I've just reviewed the new Phoebus, the Proteus watch, and their lume shot on there is amazing. They use a lot of combinations of lume, generous applications of it, mm-hmm. and they're such an interesting company to deal with, because I think they're owned by a family or husband and wife, and they, every watch they create, they try and do their best job of it, but then they're like the most critical about their own watches. So I emailed them back and said, hey guys, this lume shot is amazing that you've put on here. I mean, it's stunning. And they're like, well, yeah, we think we can get it better. It's not our best. And I'm like, well, okay, well, I look forward to reviewing that one, like, if you can get it better.
It's like green flashlight in the middle of the, you know.
Yeah, it's wow, fantastic. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that brand. Okay, well, let's talk a bit about maybe the history, and then Chris, I think you can take us through to modern day. So when we think of luminescence on a watch or lume on a watch, there's been several different generations of this. So originally, of course, when watches were first invented, they were very hard to see in the dark. You had watches in airplane cockpits, things like that, other instruments that did need to be seen, in especially in wartime, in the dark, especially when you couldn't have lights on. So there was, first of all, you had what was really known as radioluminescence. Mm-hmm. So what we'll mainly talk about today is we're going to talk about photoluminescence, radioluminescence, but we're not going to really touch on electroluminescence, which is things like Timex Indigo or what's on my Breitling watch, Chris.
Right.
It's electrical that's agitating to make it luminescence. So radioluminescence originally started out with, in fact, from Marie Curie, really.
Mm, yes.
And the discovery of radium, which is a naturally occurring material that can be mined. Mm-hmm. And then when it's mined, they notice that, hey, this thing is glowing. And right. That was great discovery of the time, was, wow, this stuff glows. I think it's got a half-life, 1,600 years
correct.
Or something.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. I mean, It's fascinating because Marie Curie's belongings are still radioactive. there's that, I think it's a, I don't know if it's a, you know, her laboratory, like the doorknob in her laboratory is just like still off the charts radiation from that. So, they started putting it in everything, because it was that solution that would glow. And I think they did it before they even really started to research or understand any sort of health effects. And I think Marie Curie knew that there was some radio, you know, like when stuff just randomly glows, you know, like there has to be some energy being put out of this and it can't all be perfect, you know. But The cat was out of the bag. They were already putting the stuff in, they were painting it and they were using it as like a health cure in some cases. I mean, just, ugh.
So. Toothpaste, because they believe that it, this energy gave energy to your body as well.
Right.
Very famously, of course, this was then made into a solution that was then painted onto clocks and dials. It was in a thin layer, so oftentimes it had to be repainted because it would degrade itself.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was an absolute revolution. And then soon to be found out years later, especially these women that were in the factories painting this luminescence on, who were painting it on by hand with a paintbrush. They were giving the paintbrush to a point in their mouths. Mm-hmm. They started getting horrendously ill from it.
Mm-hmm.
Cancers, yeah, throat cancers, mouth cancers.
Yeah.
This is a fascinating book, I believe. I think they may have made into a movie as well, all about the radium girls. I've talked about it on the channel before. I'm actually going to make a video about this subject because I think it's a very interesting period in time. And I believe I was watching Federico Talks Watches and Hands. His watch maintenance guy was said that when he was going through watchmaking school, they would show them pictures of like x-rays of people's bones where you could almost see like a watch dial imprinted on their bone because the radiation had come through a wristwatch. You know, you breathe that stuff in. So there's some people that won't even touch it. Watchmakers won't restore these radium dials because it's just so horrendous. And, you know, another 1600 years, what's it been, 60 or 70 years since they stopped using it? So
yeah.
I mean, that's nothing.
It's there was a story that I was sort of doing some research here with this, and there's a story. So the byproduct is radon gas of its degrading. So I mean, these watches aren't, you know, they're not waterproof, you know, these old, you know, watches. And so there's a story of, you know, these watchmakers that have 5 or 6 radium dials, old watches in a box in a room without ventilation. And they're like 140 times the, you know, the radon gas, like the legal amount of that would be allowed. I mean, just this is radiation. It was interesting. A couple of days ago, for some reason, some story or something came up on the news, and my wife had saw something about this in the news about, you know, older radioactive watches. And she actually like stopped and was like, hey, so you're not buying like really old watches. Like, you're careful with this stuff. I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm not like, I'm not getting anything. And so we sort of talked about, you know, the years that it was on. And I believe it, you know, so in the 40s up until about what, the early 60s, late 50s, that they were still using
it. Those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I was going to do any sort of like, if, you know, watchmaking restoration stuff, any old watches, I mean, I know watchmakers that have a Geiger counter on the bench because it just, you can't, like, not only would you not want to like expose yourself to any of that, but like, as soon as we'll talk about tritium here in a little bit, but like, as soon as you, you know, open the watch up, any dust or paint or anything that was maybe sealed inside that watch is now free in the air. And that's, again, radioactive for 1600 years. So,
yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And I think if anyone thinks, oh, this is an interesting history, but how does it affect people nowadays? Well, in fact, it affects all of us if we've got jobs, because this radium girls actually led to the first class action lawsuit against for employees towards a company. So a lot of like health and safety and stuff like that,
OSHA,
really,
et cetera,
came from that. Exactly. Yeah. Their unfortunate sacrifice has actually made being employed by a company and company versus employee health and safety regulations are better for all history forward from that point. But let's talk a little bit about tritium. So tritium originally was, they had to find something that was better than radium. So they found tritium, which is nowhere near as radioactive. Mm-hmm. And then what they first did is, although it does have some radioactivity to it, and you need an import license, don't you? It's regulated by the mm-hmm. Nuclear Regulation Commission in mm-hmm. the US.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So originally it was painted onto dials. So you might see a little T in a circle on mm-hmm. some CWC watches, I believe on some of the Speedmasters.
Yep.
So you'll see this, but now, Chris, they don't paint it on, do they?
Right. Yeah. That stopped probably in the, you know, early 2000s, late 90s would be, I'd say. And for Swiss-made watches, if you see T, Swiss-made T, that indicates that the material tritium is present. So if you have a tritium dial painted watch, it would say T, Swiss-made T on the dial. They also used Swiss T less than 25, so the bracket there, the Swiss T less than 25 specifically indicated that it emits an amount of tritium that's less than 25 millicurie. Now that's, you know, the emitted amount. I didn't check to see how much like a banana, like the phosphorus in a banana, or the, you know.
I think that's the comparison they use, right? In a banana. Yeah, and the
something
particles
like that.
Are so fine, aren't they, that they can't actually penetrate the skin, although they can be breathed in, which is obviously a concern.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then also they did Swiss T25 as well, which, you know, you'd see this on again Swiss watches that were in that maximum allowable amount of tritium that they would do. They would paint on the dial. Now I have two Swiss made T watches. Mm-hmm. They are my Zin 103/Bell & Ross and my Zin 144/Bell & Ross. And it's interesting because only a few years difference. So I sent a message to Zin asking, you know, can you give me the manufacturer date? And they placed the 144 that has almost like a golden warm color. And so much like radium, or not much like radium, but like radium, tritium breaks down the paint that it's mixed with. And sort of gives a little gold. Radium, I think, turns it like brown, you know, whereas tritium sort of has a golden hue, and it will eventually, you know, it will eventually change color. And depending on how much like exposure to UV or light that it's had, it will, you know, different colors will come out of it. So the 144, I have probably made in 1997, and then my 103 made in 2001. And what's interesting is just in the 3-4 years there, how different the application is. So the older 144, it's got the great, that vintage color loom that sort of everyone's after. But in this case, it is an authentic vintage color loom. And you hit it with UV light and it glows for like a second. It glows for like maybe a second and a half, and then it's done. It doesn't glow anymore. You can't, you know, even it's been over, you know, half life of 12 and a half years. So it's almost double that. So we look at the 103, the newer, built in 2001. And I don't quite know if it is actually tritium, because I think they either used a mixture with some Luminova, but it glows completely differently. I mean, it has some sort of yellowing, a little bit of yellowing, but nothing like the watch that's from 1997. So it's sort of interesting to sort of backtrack to see what's possible is that the dial was printed and they didn't change the printing on the dial, and they just put Luminova instead of tritium on there. So hard to get without back and forth, you know, emails with the manufacturer and actually finding some of the history on it. It's hard to know, but that's my experience with painted tritium.
Yeah, so you will see tritium. They still use tritium now, but mm-hmm. they don't paint it on, do they? Now you see it in gas tubes. So very famously, Ball mm-hmm. use these little tiny gas tubes. So they're like mini fluorescent tubes. We have Marathon use this. Chris mm-hmm. is Chris, friend to the channel, he's uses on his Marathon Navigator, and then mm-hmm. some of the tougher watches. So Do you want to explain that process of what those are?
Yeah, so the idea is, so tritium, much less radioactive than radium, much, much, much less. Still has, you know, still has some radiation, but the sapphire crystal and the case of the watch pretty much stop all of the radiation that was coming out of tritium. So only when you're working on a tritium watch where you're, you know, directly exposed to, and I want to say exposed, but we're talking, again, 25 millicurie here, so a very small amount of radiation. You know, obviously don't want to, you know, touch any of the paint, et cetera. But so the industry decided to move to the little vials, basically small glass cylinders that are filled with a gas mixture. And it's tritium, but it's also, you know, what makes tritium glow is the phosphorescence material that's mixed with it in a particular, you know, chemical. So it's not, it isn't the tritium glowing itself. It's pinging off of whatever it's mixed with. And that's how they're able to make like a bunch of different colors. So you've got, you know, greens and blues and reds and yellows and
orange as well.
Exactly. And the industry felt that it was safer because now it's encased in glass. And so it's not, and also being inside the watch. So it's sort of like double casement. So it, you know, more often you will see that.
The trade-off with tritium is the pros are that it glows constantly. It doesn't need charging under light. You don't need to see it. But then the disadvantages is that the tubes then restrict how design-wise you can put them onto a dial, don't they? So ball, you'll very commonly see that they have some of the numbers that are made of tritium tubes, but they look almost like digital numbers, don't
they?
Because they're having to be made out of these. There's no curves or...
Yeah, exactly, right. I would say they are taking that technology to the, you know, to the absolute limit. I mean, they, like, color-wise, they'll use six colors on a dial, like, of different glow, and then, yeah, spell out all the different numbers, and it has that sort of look to it. So, yeah, you're a little limited in what you can do, but again... will glow for always and will glow for 12 plus years. So
then we move on to what I'm sure everyone will be most familiar with, which is what's known as photoluminescence. So this is a process where the paint, the substance that's used in the paint, absorbs light, and it absorbs light very quickly, and then it retains the light in energy, and then the energy is released. Typically, if you've got a good application of it, you might get an hour to 90 minutes. It will still be visible after that time, but it will be heavily faded. And this, Chris, is where we get to things like Swiss Superluminova, isn't it? And Seiko's proprietary mix that they use.
Yeah. So Luminova was originally created in Japan. And during, again, this same, you know, during the war, needing to illuminate instruments in airplanes, Seiko worked with the company Nemoto and Company, who holds a patent for that phosphorescent pigment Luminova. I was actually surprised to learn that they didn't pick that up until about 1993. And you didn't really start to see that on watches until, you know, 93, 94. Luma Bright, and it's essentially a, you know, Seiko made distributed product of Luminova, so it's sort of their patented mixture, and then you have Super Luminova, which is strictly Swiss and is a brand that's dictated by the Swiss. But it does get a little confusing sometimes because they're like, oh, I've got Luminova, I've got Lumabright, I've got Super Luminova. You're like, what are we talking about? But we're talking about photoluminescent paint in various mixtures.
And they're given numbers, aren't they? Typically like C1, BGW9. The advantage is that it's a paint, so you can get very artistic with how it's... You can also make it into solid plastic formed elements, I think, as well. So like rings, bezel rings and stuff like that. You can inlay it into bezels. You can inlay it into bezels and then encase it in a resin or encase it in a sapphire. And because of the nature of it, you can color it, which brings us to this, what I find quite a weird sort of transition of all three of the elements. And I'm going to make a video on this, so I won't kind of lose the plot too much. But now we have this trend where supernova is then, which will never change color. It will never, it will never change color. We should mention that.
It's stable forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it will never patina. We now get this weird sort of crossing of paths where supernova is then aged to look like decaying radium,
right?
Which gives this peach, or depending on, you know, you've got a joke, it's like between peach and poo is kind of the two colors, isn't it? You either
yes,
get like
that's
the,
a good, right.
the look the peachy glow, oh, or right. you go all the way right to the brown section of the Pantone color chart.
Yeah, exactly. And they specifically, so they have so C1 is white, C3 yellow, C5 is greenish yellow, C7's green, C9's a bluish green. So you usually hear like a C9 with the, and then the BGW9 is that light bluish white with about 95% glow of C3. And so that's a very, very popular. So they have all these mixtures. And then they have a mixture that is called old radium that appears to be aged vintage tritium loom or radium loom. And glows a bright yellowish green at night. So,
yeah, it's a, such a weird. I'm gonna definitely have to do a YouTube video on this. And the other thing that I find interesting with the loom as well is it's hard to apply onto hands, isn't there? So you can have a watch that has supernova, but it also depends on how it's been layered as well.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. You'll find they will put multiple layers on. So think of like a powder mixture in a paint, in a like sort of a clear coat paint. Well, you know, depending on the thickness of the powder, I mean, you want to be able to paint this on, but at the same time, you know, in order to have a really thick, you know, amount of glow, they might apply 3, 4, 5 layers of luminous paint to the hands in order to get the glow that they're looking for. And you can certainly tell if you've ever looked at or purchased aftermarket Seiko hands. They just do not live up to. I mean, I can take a UV light to my little extra hands box, you know, in my workshop box here, and I just immediately know which ones are OEM and which ones aren't, because they've patented that mixture. The phosphorescent mixture and that pigment, they patented that pigment. So there's only, you know, one company making it for them, or Seiko is probably making it themselves. I'm sure they're mining the sulfur and et cetera to make it themselves. But such a difference in the last probably 10, 15 years that they've been able to really, you know, punch that color up. So it gets a little bit of sunlight and poof, it pops right out.
Yeah, Seiko are so good at it. I mean, I joke in my channel about it being almost burns into your retina as soon as you right. charge it, don't you? You blink right. and you got that Seiko, yeah. the outline of the SKX 009 yeah. or the Turtle or yeah. whatever. Yeah. But yeah, you're spot on, aren't you? I think when we were playing around with my Seiko Turtle and we put those first set of hands on, as soon as it got in the dark, you could tell that the hands were not original. And then we got very lucky the next time that they... Because they even... a slightly different glow completely throw off the dial.
Exactly. Yeah. It, or yeah. like even like a different color. I've seen that too, where like not vintage, but like, you know, older 90s, 2000 watches where you'll look at the hour hand versus the minute hand and you'll just know, you're like, oh, the minute hand was replaced. And they're like, how do you know that? And you're like, well, look at it under a UV light. It just looks like a different color. They just didn't match the color, you know, those sorts of things. We should also talk about sort of the, having loom on a watch and how it really changed diving, you know, as a possibility, and then sort of the folks that are like, does it really matter, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing. That's one thing that when I first ever got into watches, you go through this inevitable stage of like, well, you know, loom is it really necessary? Because if you'd had to see a watch in the dark, then hands down the electroluminescence is
right.
you know, better bang out.
Right.
And I didn't realize this whole concept of actually when you're diving with it, the UV reflected through the sea actually mm-hmm. makes the watch glow mm-hmm. or more visible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then being able to sort of pick that out. So dive watches really benefited from Luminova. You know, but I definitely feel that the industry maybe went a little, you know, maybe went for Looming everything, you know, should Loom be showing up on any sort of dress watch? Probably not. Does it matter? You know, does it really matter? No. And then the thought of, well, you know, after being in the dark for 10 hours, you know, are you really going to be able to see it? And like, you're really going to be able to tell what time it is, you know? And the only time I ever use it is like camping.
Yeah.
Was it like, if I'm curled up in a sleeping bag and it is the middle of the night, I'm not turning a light on because I don't want to wake everybody in the place up. So I just kind of press my eyeball to the watch, and you're like, oh, okay. You know, and you're like, oh, all right, I know what time it is now. It's, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, isn't it? Like my little Breitling B1 has both Luminova on it, Super Luminova on it, and electroluminescence. So right. You can press right. The thing, but it also they've gone to the trouble of looming the hands as well and the dial. But it's definitely a super interesting subject. I know that perhaps listening to us talk about it isn't as effective as if we were doing a video version of this, but it's certainly a subject that I think gets brought up in the most. And you have to put it in every watch review. If I miss a watch review and right. don't have a Loom shot in there, yeah. then yeah. rightly I'm called out on it. It's right. something that's a big buying factor for people.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. For me, I think it looks cool. I mean, it's a cool technology. But as far as like practicality, you know, yeah, I'm not diving with it, so I don't need to see it underwater. And then I'm not only occasionally super in the middle of the night would I look. I do not typically wear my watch when I sleep. So again, just for camping and stuff, I would, you know, it would be a benefit. But
it's an interesting trend, isn't it? I think you've got to be careful as well if you're going to inlay the Luminova into a bezel. You see a lot of people that either encase the bezel, they put the Loom on and then encase the bezel in like a sapphire or a resin or something like that. You've got to have a good application of it.
Yeah.
You paint it straight in there.
I had a 12-hour ceramic bezel that was loomed. They had a sort of a caveat where they, you know, a scent with it that was like, hey, so just to let you know, like if you use like heavy duty soap, you could literally just wipe away, you just wash away the luminous coating on this. So you got to be careful because we coated it with like a single layer of lacquer or whatever. And so eventually that'll start to fade. Going all the way back to what we sort of started talking about in the beginning, where it's like a showstopper, I feel like sometimes people give the Loom, you know, maybe too much of a part of a watch, like it's too important.
I would agree with you a little bit there, yeah.
You know, where they're just like, oh well, you know, oh well, I love the sapphire and the domed and it's screw down crown and it's got the stats and it's got this, you know, movement and it's fantastic. Oh, but they didn't, you know, they didn't Loom this part of it, or they had this weird, you know, and I guess for, you know, if for some folks that need it, require it, you know, we're certainly talking about like TJ in the cockpit, you know. If the lights go out in the cockpit, you need to be able to see them. You need to be able to look down, start your chronograph, and know how much time has happened. So
oh, exactly, and that's why he was loving his the navigator, the Marathon Navigator, because of that tritium,
right? Exactly.
And a lot of military watches you see, or at least ones that were designed for a military purpose, have used tritium,
yeah.
don't they?
Yeah, exactly. I think that for me, definitely it's a nice to have. But it's not a game changer. Like it doesn't break the watch if it doesn't have a app. You know, I think my old Hamilton khaki. I think sometimes people get sort of upset that the Loom is not as, you know, there's hardly any Loom on the on that watch. But again, it's a field watch, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, if you look at it and you know it's completely pitch dark, you can tell what time it is, and that's fine.
Yeah,
you're not
exactly.
gonna dive with that watch, it's gonna be fine.
Yeah, if it was so crucial to a function of your life that you had to see it in the dark, then you would just buy a G-Shock, I guess.
Right, yeah, exactly, right.
The flippant again, response to it.
Yeah, get it.
Awesome. Well, that's been a really fascinating subject. So guys, let us know what you think over on the Facebook group. We're building up quite a cool little community there. As always, we really appreciate you listening, and we'll see you next time on Casual Watch Talk. Thanks, guys. Bye.